Chapter 9 Reaping 1 As they stepped into the stable, which was lit by one dim gas lamp, a shadow moved out of one of the stalls. Roland, who had belted on both guns, now drew them. Shimi looked at him with an uncertain smile, holding a stirrup in one hand. Then the smile broadened, his eyes flashed with happiness, and he ran toward them. Roland holstered his guns and made ready to embrace the boy, but Shimi ran past him and threw himself into Cuthbert's arms. "Whoa, whoa," Cuthbert said, first staggering back comically and then lifting Shimi off his feet. "You like to knock me over, boy."
"She got you out," Shimi cried. "Knew she would, so I did. Good old Susan."
Shimi looked around at Susan, who stood beside Roland. She was still pale, but now seemed composed. Shimi turned back to Cuthbert and planted a kiss directly in the center of Bert's forehead.
"Whoa," Bert said again. "What's that for?"
"'Cause I love you, good old Arthur Heath. You saved my life."
"Well, maybe I did," Cuthbert said, laughing in an embarrassed way. His borrowed sombrero, too large to begin with, now sat comically askew on his head. "But if we don't get a move on, I won't have saved it for long."
"Horses are all saddled," Shimi said. "Susan told me to do it, and I did. I did it just right. I just have to put this stirrup on Mr. Richard Stockworth's horse, because the one on there's about worn through."
"That's a job for later," Alan said, taking the stirrup. He put it aside, then turned to Roland. "Where do we go?" Roland's first thought was that they should return to the Thorin mausoleum. Shimi reacted with instant horror.
"The boneyard? And with Demon Moon at the full?"
He shook his head so violently that his sombrero came off and his hair flew from side to side.
"They're dead in there," sighed Dearborn, "but if you tease them during the time of the demon, they's apt to get up and walk."
"It's no good anyway," Susan said. "The women of the town will be lining the way from Seafront with flowers and filling the mausoleum, too. Olive will be in charge if she's able, but my aunt and Coral are apt to be in the company. Those aren't ladies we want to meet." "All right," Roland said. "Let's mount up and ride. Think about it, Susan. You too, Shimi. We want a place where we can hide up until dawn, at least. And it should be a place we can get to in less than an hour. Off the Great Road, and in any direction from Hambry but northwest."
"Why not northwest?" Alan asked.
"Because that's where we're going now. We've got a job to do, and we're going to let them know we're doing it. Eldred Jonas, most of all." He offered a thin blade of a smile. "I want him to know the game is over. No more castles. The real gunslingers are here. Let's see if he can deal with them." 2. An hour later, with the moon well above the trees, Roland's quartet arrived at the Sitgo oil patch. They rode out parallel to the Great Road, for safety's sake, but as it happened, the caution was wasted. They saw not one rider on the road going in either direction. "It's as if reaping's been cancelled this year," Susan thought. Then she thought of the red-handed stuffies and shivered. They would have painted Roland's hands red tomorrow night, and still would if they were caught. Not just him, either. All of us. Shimi, too. They left the horses, and Capricoso, who had trotted ill-temperedly but nimbly behind them on a tether tied to some long-dead pumping equipment in the southeastern corner of the patch, and then walked slowly toward the working derricks, which were clustered in the same area. They spoke in whispers when they spoke at all. Roland doubted if that was necessary, but whispers here seemed natural enough. To Roland, Sitgo was far spookier than the graveyard, and while he doubted that the dead in that latter place awoke, even when old Demon was full, there were some very unquiet corpses here, squalling zombies that stood rusty weird in the moonlight, with their pistons going up and down like marching feet. Roland led them into the active part of the patch nevertheless, past a sign which read, "How's your hard hat?" and another reading, "We produce oil, we refine safety." They stopped at the foot of a derrick, grinding so loudly that Roland had to shout in order to be heard. "Shimi, give me a couple of those big bangers." Shimi had taken a pocketful from Susan's saddlebag and now handed a pair of them over. Roland took Bert by the arm and pulled him forward. There was a square of rusty fencing around the derrick, and when the boys tried to climb it, the horizontals snapped like old bones. They looked at each other in the running shadows, combined of machinery and moonlight, nervous and amused. Susan twitched Roland's arm. "Be careful," she shouted, over the rhythmic wompa, wompa, wompa of the derrick machinery. She didn't look frightened, he saw, only excited and alert. He grinned, pulled her forward, and kissed the lobe of her ear. "Be ready to run," he whispered. "If we do this right, there's going to be a new candle here at Sitco, a hellacious big one." He and Cuthbert ducked under the lowest strut of the rusty derrick tower and stood next to the equipment, wincing at the cacophony. Roland wondered that it hadn't torn itself apart years ago. Most of the works were housed in rusty metal blocks, but he could see a gigantic turning shaft of some kind, gleaming with oil that must be supplied by automated jets. Up this close, there was a gassy smell that reminded him of the jet that flared rhythmically on the other side of the oil patch. "Giant farts!" Cuthbert shouted. "What? I said it smells like... Ah, never mind. Let's do it if we can. Can we?" Roland didn't know. He walked toward the machinery, crying out beneath metal cowls which were painted a faded, rusting green. Bert followed with some reluctance. The two of them slid into a short aisle, smelly and baking hot, that took them almost directly beneath the derrick. Ahead of them, the shaft at the end of the piston turned steadily, shedding oily teardrops down its smooth sides. Beside it was a curved pipe, almost surely an overflow pipe, Roland thought. An occasional drop of crude oil fell from its lip, and there was a black puddle on the ground beneath. He pointed at it, and Cuthbert nodded. Shouting would do no good in here. The world was a roaring, squealing din. Roland curled one hand around his friend's neck and pulled Cuthbert's ear to his lips. He held a big bang up in front of Bert's eyes with the other. "Light it and run," he said. "I'll hold it, give you as much time as I can. That's for my benefit as much as for yours. I want a clear path back through that machinery. Do you understand?" Cuthbert nodded against Roland's lips, then turned the gunslinger's head so he could speak in the same fashion. "What if there's enough gas here to burn the air when I make a spark?" Roland stepped back, raised his palms in a how-do-I-know gesture. Cuthbert laughed and drew out a box of sulfur matches which he had scooped off Avery's desk before leaving. He asked with his eyebrows if Roland was ready. Roland nodded. The wind was blowing hard, but under the derrick the surrounding machinery cut it off, and the flame from the sulfur rose straight. Roland held out the big banger and had a momentary painful memory of his mother, how she had hated these things, how she had always been sure that he would lose an eye or a finger to one. Cuthbert tapped his chest above his heart and kissed his palm in the universal gesture of good luck. Then he touched the flame to the fuse. It began to sputter. Bert turned, pretended to bang off a covered block of machinery. That was Bert, Roland thought. He would joke on the gallows. And then dashed back down the short corridor they'd used to get here. Roland held the round firework as long as he dared, then lobbed it into the overflow pipe. He winced as he turned away, half expecting what Bert was afraid of, that the very air would explode. It didn't. He ran down the short aisle, came into the clear, and saw Cuthbert standing just outside the broken bit of fencing. Roland flapped both hands at him. "Go, you idiot, go!" And then the world blew up behind him. The sound was a deep, belching thud that seemed to shove his eardrums inward and suck the breath out of his throat. The ground rolled under his feet like a wave under a boat, and a large, warm hand planted itself in the center of his back and shoved him forward. He thought he ran with it for a step, maybe even two or three steps, and then he was lifted off his feet and hurled at the fence, where Cuthbert was no longer standing. Cuthbert was sprawled on his back, staring up at something behind Roland. The boy's eyes were wide and wondering, his mouth hung open. Roland could see all this very well, because Sitco was now as bright as in full daylight.
They had lit their own reaping bonfire, it seemed, a night early and much brighter than the one in town could ever hope to be. He went skidding on his knees to where Cuthbert lay and grabbed him under one arm. From behind them came a vast, ripping roar, and now chunks of metal began to fall around them. They got up and ran toward where Alain stood in front of Susan and Sheenie, trying to protect them. Roland took a quick look back over his shoulder and saw that the remains of the derrick, about half of it still stood, were glowing blackish red like a heated horseshoe around a flaring yellow torch that ran perhaps 150 feet into the sky. It was a start. He didn't know how many other derricks they could fire before folk began arriving from town, but he was determined to do as many as possible, no matter what the risks might be. Blowing up the tankers at Hanging Rock was only half the job. Farson's source had to be wiped out. Further firecrackers dropped down further overflow pipes turned out not to be necessary. There was a network of interconnected pipes under the oil patch, most filled with natural gas that had leaked in through ancient decaying seals. Roland and Cuthbert had no more than reached the others when there was a fresh explosion, and a fresh tower of flame erupted from a derrick to the right of the one they had set afire. A moment later, a third derrick, this one 60 full yards away from the first two, exploded with a dragon's roar. The ironwork tore free of its anchoring concrete pillars like a tooth pulled from a decayed gum. It rose on a cushion of blazing blue and yellow, attained a height of perhaps 70 feet, then heeled over and came crashing back down, spewing sparks in every direction. Another. Another. And yet another. The five young people stood in their corner, stunned, holding their hands up to shield their eyes from the glare. Now the oil patch flared like a birthday cake, and the heat baking toward them was enormous. "Gods be kind," Alain whispered. If they lingered here much longer, Roland realized, they would be popped like corn. There were the horses to consider, too. They were well away from the main focus of the explosions, but there was no guarantee that the focus would stay where it was. Already he saw two derricks that hadn't even been working engulfed in flames. The horses would be terrified. Hell, he was terrified. "Come on!" he shouted. They ran for the horses through shifting yellow-orange brilliance. 3. At first Jonas thought it was going on in his own head, that the explosions were part of their lovemaking. Lovemaking, yeah, lovemaking horse shit. He and Coral made love no more than donkeys did sums. But it was something. Oh, yes, indeed it was. He'd been with passionate women before, ones who took you into a kind of oven place and then held you there, staring with greedy intensity as they pumped their hips. But until Coral, he'd never been with a woman that sparked such a powerfully harmonic chord in himself. With sex, he had always been the kind of man who took it when it came and forgot it when it didn't. But with Coral, he only wanted to take it, take it, and take it some more. When they were together, they made love like cats or ferrets, twisting and hissing and clawing. They bit at each other and cursed at each other, and so far none of it was even close to enough. When he was with her, Jonas sometimes felt as if he were being fried in sweet oil. Tonight there had been a meeting with the Horsemen's Association, which had pretty much become the Farson Association in these latter days. Jonas had brought them up to date, had answered their idiotic questions, and had made sure they understood what they'd be doing the next day. With that done, he had checked on Rhea, who had been installed in Kimba Reimer's old suite. She hadn't even noticed Jonas peering in at her. She sat in Reimer's high-ceilinged, book-lined study, behind Reimer's ironwood desk, in Reimer's upholstered chair, looking as out of place as a whore's bloomers on a church altar. On Reimer's desk was the wizard's rainbow. She was passing her hands back and forth above it and muttering rapidly under her breath, but the ball remained dark. Jonas had locked her in and had gone to Coral. She had been waiting for him in the parlor where tomorrow's conversational would have been held. There were plenty of bedrooms in that wing, but it was to her dead brother's that she had led him, and not by accident either, Jonas was sure.
There they made love in the canopied bed Hart Thorin would never share with his Jilly. It was fierce, as it had always been, and Jonas was approaching his orgasm when the first oil derrick blew. "Christ, she's something," he thought. "There's never in the whole damned world been a woman like then." Two more explosions in rapid succession, and Coral froze for a moment beneath him before beginning to thrust her hips again. "Sitko," she said in a hoarse, panting voice. "Yar," he growled and began to thrust with her. He had lost all interest in making love, but they had reached the point where it was impossible to stop, even under threat of death or dismemberment. 2 minutes later, he was striding, naked, toward Thorin's little lick of a balcony, his half-erect penis wagging from side to side ahead of him like some half-wit's idea of a magic wand. Coral was a step behind him, as naked as he was. "Why now?" she burst out as Jonas thrust open the balcony door. "I could have come 3 more times. Jonas ignored her. The countryside looking northwest was a moon-gilded darkness, except where the oil patch was. There he saw a fierce yellow core of light. It was spreading and brightening even as he watched, one thudding explosion after another hammered across the intervening miles. He felt a curious darkening in his mind. That feeling had been there ever since the brat Dearborn, by some febrile leap of intuition, had recognized him for who and what he was. Making love to the energetic Coral melted that feeling a little, but now, looking at the burning tangle of fire which had 5 minutes ago been the good man's oil reserves, it came back with debilitating intensity, like a swamp fever that sometimes quits the flesh but hides in the bones and never really leaves. "You're in the West," Dearborn had said. "The soul of a man such as you can never leave the West." Of course it was true, and he hadn't needed any such titmonkey as Will Dearborn to tell him, but now that it had been said, there was a part of his mind that couldn't stop thinking about it. Fucking Will Dearborn. Where exactly was he now, him and his pair of good-mannered mates? In Avery's Calabozo? Jonas didn't think so. Not anymore. Fresh explosions ripped the night. Down below, men who had run and shouted in the wake of the early morning's assassinations were running and shouting again. "It's the biggest reaping firework that ever was," Coral said in a low voice. Before Jonas could reply, there was a hard hammering on the bedroom door. It was thrown open a second later, and Clay Reynolds came clumping across the room, wearing a pair of blue jeans and nothing else. His hair was wild, his eyes were wilder. "Bad news from town, Eldred," he said. "Dearborn and the other two in-world brats, 3 more explosions, falling almost on top of each other. From the blazing Sitgo oil patch, a great red-orange fireball rose lazily into the black of night, faded, disappeared." Reynolds walked out onto the balcony and stood between them at the railing, unmindful of their nakedness. He stared at the fireball with wide, wondering eyes until it was gone. As gone as the brats. Jonas felt that curious, debilitating gloom trying to steal over him again. "How did they get away?" he asked. "Do you know? Does Avery?"
"Avery's dead. The deputy who was with him, too. 'Twas another deputy found him, Todd Bridger. Eldred, what's going on out there? What happened?"
"Oh, that's your boys," Coral said. "Didn't take them long to start their own reaping party, did it?" How much heart do they have? Jonas asked himself. It was a good question, maybe the only one that mattered. Were they now done making trouble, or just getting started? He once more wanted to be out of here, out of Seafront, out of Hambry, out of Magus. Suddenly, more than anything, he wanted to be miles and wheels and leagues away. He had bounded around his hillock, it was too late to go back, and now he felt horribly exposed. "Clay?"
"Yes, Eldred?"
But the man's eyes and his mind were still on the conflagration at Sitgo. Jonas took his shoulder and turned Reynolds toward him. Jonas felt his own mind starting to pick up speed, ticking past points and details, and welcomed the feeling. That queer, dark sense of fatalism faded and disappeared. "How many men are here?" he asked. Reynolds frowned, thought about it.
35, he said, maybe.
"How many armed?"
"With guns?"
"No, with pea blowers, you damned fool." Probably... Reynolds pulled his lower lip, frowning more fiercely than ever. Probably a dozen. That's guns likely to work, he can.
The big boys from the Horsemen's Association still all here?
I think so.
Get Lengel and Renfrew. At least you won't have to wake him up. They'll all be up, and most of them right down there.
Jonas jerked a thumb at the courtyard. Tell Renfrew to put together an advance party. Armed men. I'd like 8 or 10, but I'll take 5. Have that old woman's cart harnessed to the strongest, hardiest pony this place has got. Tell that old fuck Miguel that if the pony he chooses dies in the traces between here and Hanging Rock, he'll be using his wrinkled old balls for earplugs.
Coral Thorin barked brief, harsh laughter. Reynolds glanced at her, did a double take at her breasts, then looked back at Jonas with an effort.
"Where's Roy?" Jonas asked.
Reynolds looked up.
"Third floor with some little serving maid? Kick him out," Jonas said. "It's his job to get the old bitch ready to ride."
"We're going?"
"Soon as we can. You and me first with Renfrew's boys and Lengel behind with the rest of the men. You just make sure Hash Renfrew's with us, Clay. That man's got sand in his craw."
"What about the horses out on the drop?"
"Never mind the ever-fucking horses."
There was another explosion at Sitgo. Another fireball floated into the sky. Jonas couldn't see the dark clouds of smoke which must be rushing up, or smell the oil. The wind, out of the east and into the west, would be carrying both away from town.
"But just do as I say."
Jonas now saw his priorities in clear ascending order. The horses were on the bottom. Farson could find horses damn near anywhere. Above them were the tankers gathered at Hanging Rock. They were more important than ever now because the source was gone. Lose the tankers, and the big coffin hunters could forget going home. Yet most important of all was Farson's little piece of the Wizard's Rainbow. It was the one truly irreplaceable item. If it was broken, let it be broken in the care of George Letigo, not that of Eldred Jonas.
"Get moving," he told Reynolds. "DePape rides after with Lengel's men, you with me. Go on, make it happen."
"And me?" Coral asked. He reached out and tugged her toward him.
"I ain't forgot you, darling," he said.
Coral nodded and reached between his legs, oblivious of the staring Clay Reynolds.
"Aye," she said, "and I ain't forgot you."
4. They escaped Sitgo with ringing ears and slightly singed around the edges, but not really hurt. Shimi riding double behind Cuthbert and Capricoso clattering after at the end of his long lead. It was Susan who came up with the place they should go, and like most solutions, it seemed completely obvious once someone had thought of it. And so, not long after Reaping Eve had become Reaping Morn, the 5 of them came to the hut in the bad grass where Susan and Roland had on several occasions met to make love. Cuthbert and Alain unrolled blankets, then sat on them to examine the guns they had liberated from the sheriff's office. They had also found Bert's slingshot. "These are hard calibers," Alain said, holding one up with the cylinder sprung and peering one-eyed down the barrel. "If they don't throw too high or wide, Roland, I think we can do some business with them."
"I wish we had that rancher's machine gun," Cuthbert said wistfully.
"You know what Court would say about a gun like that?" Roland asked, and Cuthbert burst out laughing. So did Alain.
"Who's Court?" Susan asked.
"The tough man Eldred Jonas only thinks he is," Alain said. "He was our teacher."
Roland suggested that they catch an hour or two of sleep. The next day was apt to be difficult. That it might also be their last was something he didn't feel he had to say.
"Alain, are you listening?"
Alain, who knew perfectly well that Roland wasn't speaking of his ears or his attention span, nodded.
"Do you hear anything?"
"Not yet."
"Keep at it."
"I will.
But I can't promise anything. The touch is fluky, you know that as well as I do."
"Just keep trying."
Shimi had carefully spread 2 blankets in the corner next to his proclaimed best friend.
"He's Roland, and he's Alain. Who are you, good old Arthur Heath? Who are you, really?"
"Cuthbert's my name." He stuck out his hand. "Cuthbert Allgood. How do you do, and how do you do, and how do you do again?"
Shimi shook the offered hand, then began giggling. It was a cheerful, unexpected sound, and made them all smile. Smiling hurt Roland a little, and he guessed that if he could see his own face, he'd observe a pretty good burn from being so close to the exploding derricks.
Keyuth Bert, Shimi said, giggling. Oh, my, Keyuth Bert. That's a funny name. No wonder you're such a funny fellow. Keyuth Bert. Oh, that's a pip, a real pip.
Cuthbert smiled and nodded. Can I kill him now, Roland, if we don't need him any longer? Save him a bit, why don't you? Roland said. Then turned to Susan, his own smile fading. Will thee walk out with me a bit, Sue? I'd talk to thee. She looked up at him, trying to read his face. All right. She held out her hand. Roland took it. They walked into the moonlight together. And beneath its light, Susan felt dread take hold of her heart. Five. They walked out in silence through sweet-smelling grass that tasted good to cows and horses, even as it was expanding in their bellies, first bloating and then killing them. It was high, at least a foot taller than Roland's head, and still green as summer. Children sometimes got lost in the bad grass and died there, but Susan had never feared to be here with Roland, even when there were no sky markers to steer by. His sense of direction was uncannily perfect. "Sue, thee disobeyed me in the matter of the guns," he said at last. She looked at him, smiling, half amused and half angry. "Does thee wish to be back in thy cell, then, thee and thy friends?" "No, of course not. Such bravery." He held her close and kissed her. When he drew back, they were both breathing hard. He took her by the arms and looked into her eyes. "But thee mustn't disobey me this time." She looked at him steadily, saying nothing. "Thee knows," he said, "thee knows what I'd tell thee."
"Aye, perhaps."
"Say. Better you than me, maybe."
"I'm to stay at the hut while you and the others go. Shimi and I are to stay."
He nodded. "Will you? Will thee?" She thought of how unfamiliar and wretched Roland's gun had felt in her hand as she held it beneath the serape, of the wide, unbelieving look in Dave's eyes as the bullet she'd fired into his chest flung him backward, of how the first time she'd tried to shoot Sheriff Avery, the bullet had only succeeded in setting her own clothing afire, although he had been right there in front of her. They didn't have a gun for her unless she took one of Roland's. She couldn't use one very well in any case, and more important, she didn't want to use one. Under those circumstances, and with Shimi to think about too, it was best she just stay out of the way. Roland was waiting patiently. She nodded.
"Shimi and I'll wait for thee, it's my promise."
He smiled, relieved.
"Now pay me back with honesty, Roland."
"If I can." She looked up at the moon, shuddered at the ill-omened face she saw, and looked back at Roland.
"What chance thee'll come back to me?"
He thought about this very carefully, still holding to her arms. "Far better than Jonas thinks," he said at last. "We'll wait at the edge of the bad grass and should be able to mark his coming well enough."
"Aye, the herd of horses I saw, he may come without the horses,"
Roland said, not knowing how well he had matched Jonas's thinking. "But his folk will make noise even if they come without the herd. If there's enough of them, we'll see them as well. They'll cut a line through the grass like a part in hair." Susan nodded. She had seen this many times from the drop, the mysterious parting of the bad grass as groups of men rode through it.
"If they're looking for thee, Roland? If Jonas sends scouts ahead?"
"I doubt he'll bother," Roland shrugged. "If they do, why, we'll kill them. Silent, if we can. Killing's what we were trained to do. We'll do it." She turned his hands over, and now she was gripping his arms instead of the other way around. She looked impatient and afraid.
"He hasn't answered my question. What chance I'll see thee back?"
He thought it over. "Even toss," he said at last. She closed her eyes as if struck, drew in a breath, let it out, opened her eyes again.
"Bad," she said. "It may be not as bad as I thought." "And if thee doesn't come back, Shimi and I go west, as thee said before?"
"Aye,"
to Gilead. There'll be a place of safety and respect for you there, dear, no matter what. But it's especially important that you go if you don't hear the tankers explode. He knows that, doesn't he?
To warn your people, thy quartet.
Roland nodded.
I'll warn them, no fear, and keep Shimi safe, too. He's as much the reason we've got this far as anything I've done.
Roland was counting on Shimi for more than she knew. If he and Bert and Alain were killed, it was Shimi who would stabilize her, give her reason to go on.
When does thee leave? Susan asked. Do we have time to make love?
We have time, but perhaps it's best we don't, he said. It's going to be hard enough to leave thee again without, unless you really want to. His eyes half pleaded with her to say yes.
Let's just go back and lie down a bit, she said, and took his hand.
For a moment it trembled on her lips to tell him that she was kindled with his child, but at the last moment she kept silent. There was enough for him to think about without that added mayhap, and she didn't want to pass such happy news beneath such an ugly moon. It would surely be bad luck. They walked back through high grass that was already springing together along their path. Outside the hut, he turned her toward him, put his hands on her cheeks, and softly kissed her again.
I will love thee forever, Susan, he said. Come whatever storms.
She smiled. The upward movement of her cheeks spilled a pair of tears from her eyes.
Come whatever storms, she agreed.
She kissed him again, and they went inside. 6. The moon had begun to descend when a party of 8 rode out beneath the arch with Come in Peace writ upon it in the great letters. Jonas and Reynolds were in the lead. Behind them came Rhea's black wagon, drawn by a trotting pony that looked strong enough to go all night and half the next day. Jonas had wanted to give her a driver, but Rhea refused.
Never was an animal I didn't get on with better than any man ever could, she told him,
and that seemed to be true. The reins lay limp in her lap. The pony worked smart without them. The other 5 men consisted of Hash Renfrew, Quint, and 3 of Renfrew's best vaqueros. Coral had wanted to come as well, but Jonas had different ideas.
If we're killed, you can go on more or less as before, he'd said. There'll be nothing to tie you to us.
Without ye, I'm not sure there'd be any reason to go on, she said.
Ah, quit that schoolgirl shit. It don't become you. You'd find plenty of reasons to keep staggering down the path if you had to put your mind to it. If all goes well, as I expect it will, and ye still want to be with me, ride out of here as soon as you get word of our success. There's a town west of here in the Vicastus Mountains, Ritzy. Go there on the fastest horse you can swing a leg over. You'll be there ahead of us by days, no matter how smart we're able to push along. Find a respectable inn that'll take a woman on her own, if there is such a thing in Ritzy. Wait. When we get there with the tankers, you just fall into the column at my right hand. Have you got it?
She had it. One woman in 1,000 was Coral Thorin, sharp as Lord Satan and able to fuck like Satan's favorite harlot. Now, if things only turned out to be as simple as he'd made them sound. Jonas fell back until his horse was pacing alongside the black cart. The ball was out of its bag and lay in Rhea's lap.
Anything? He asked.
He both hoped and dreaded to see that deep pink pulse inside it again.
Nay, it'll speak when it needs to, though. Count on it.
Then what good are you, old woman?
You'll know when the time comes, Rhea said, looking at him with arrogance,
and some fear as well, he was happy to see. Jonas spurred his horse back to the head of the little column. He had decided to take the ball from Rhea at the slightest sign of trouble. In truth, it had already inserted its strange, addicting sweetness into his head. He thought about that single pink pulse of light he'd seen far too much.
Balls, he told himself. Battle sweat's all I've got. Once this business is over, I'll be my old self again.
Nice, if true, but... But he had, in truth, begun to wonder. Renfrew was now riding with Clay. Jonas nudged his horse in between them. His dicky leg was aching like a bastard, another bad sign.
Langell?
He asked Renfrew. Putting together a good bunch, Renfrew said. Don't you fear Fran Langell. 30 men.
30? God, Harry's body, I told you I wanted 40. 40 at least.
Renfrew measured him with a pale-eyed glance, then winced at a particularly vicious gust of the freshening wind. He pulled his neckerchief up over his mouth and nose. The vax riding behind had already done so.
How afraid of these 3 boys are you, Jonas? Afraid for both of us, I guess, since you're too stupid to know who they are or what they're capable of.
He raised his own neckerchief, then forced his voice into a more reasonable timbre. It was best he do so. He needed these bumpkins yet a while longer. Once the ball was turned over to Letigo, that might change.
Though mayhap we'll never see them.
It's likely they're already 30 miles from here and riding west as fast as their horses will take 'em,
Renfrew agreed.
I'd give a crown to know how they got loose.
What does it matter, you idiot? Jonas thought, but said nothing.
As for Langill's men, they'll be the hardest boys he can lay hands on. If it comes to a fight, those 30 will fight like 60.
Jonas's eyes briefly met Clay's.
I'll believe it when I see it, Clay's brief glance said, and Jonas knew again why he had always liked this one better than Roy DePape.
How many armed?
With guns?
Maybe half. They'll be no more than an hour behind us.
Good. At least their back door was covered. It would have to do. And he couldn't wait to be rid of that thrice-cursed ball.
Oh?
Whispered a sly, half-mad voice from a place much deeper than his heart.
Oh, can't you?
Jonas ignored the voice until it stilled. Half an hour later, they turned off the road and onto the drop. Several miles ahead, moving in the wind like a silver sea, was the Badgrass. 7. Around the time that Jonas and his party were riding down the drop, Roland, Cuthbert, and Alain were swinging up into their saddles. Susan and Shimi stood by the doorway to the hut, holding hands and watching them solemnly. "They'll hear the explosions when the tankers go, and smell the smoke," Roland said. "Even with the wind the wrong way, I think they'll smell it." Then, no more than an hour later, more smoke. "There," he pointed. "That'll be the brush piled in front of the canyon's mouth."
"And if we don't see those things?"
"Into the west. But thee will, Sue. I swear thee will." She stepped forward, put her hands on his thigh, and looked up at him in the latening moonlight. He bent, put his hand lightly against the back of her head, put his mouth on her mouth.
"Go thy course in safety,"
Susan said as she drew back from him.
"Aye," Shimi added suddenly, "stand and be true, all three."
He came forward himself and shyly touched Cuthbert's boot. Cuthbert reached down, took Shimi's hand, and shook it.
"Take care of her, old boy."
Shimi nodded seriously.
"I will."
"Come on," Roland said. He felt that if he looked at her solemn, upturned face again, he would cry. "Let's go." They rode slowly away from the hut. Before the grass closed behind them, hiding it from view, he looked back a final time. "Sue, I love thee." She smiled. It was a beautiful smile.
"Bird and bear and hare and fish," she said.
The next time Roland saw her, she was caught inside the wizard's glass. Eight. What Roland and his friends saw west of the Badgrass had a harsh, lonely beauty. The wind was lifting great sheets of sand across the stony desert floor. The moonlight turned these into foot-racing phantoms. At moments, Hanging Rock was visible, some 2 wheels distant, and the mouth of Eyebolt Canyon 2 wheels farther on. Sometimes both were gone, hidden by the dust. Behind them, the tall grass made a soughing, singing sound.
"How do you boys feel?" Roland asked. "All's well?" They nodded.
"There's going to be a lot of shooting, I think."
"We'll remember the faces of our fathers," Cuthbert said.
"Yes," Roland agreed, almost absently. "We'll remember them very well." He stretched in the saddle. "The wind's in our favor, not theirs. That's one good thing. We'll hear them coming. We must judge the size of the group, all right?"
They both nodded.
"If Jonas has still got his confidence, he'll come soon in a small party, whatever gunnies he can put together on short notice, and he'll have the ball. In that case, we'll ambush them, kill them all, and take the wizard's rainbow."
Alain and Cuthbert sat quiet, listening intently. The wind gusted, and Roland clapped a hand to his hat to keep it from flying off.
"If he fears more trouble from us, I think he's apt to come later on, and with a bigger party of riders. If that happens, we'll let them pass. Then, if the wind is our friend and keeps up, we'll fall in behind them."
Cuthbert began to grin.
"Oh, Roland," he said, "your father would be proud. Only 14, but cozy as the devil."
15 come next moonrise," Roland said seriously.
"If we do it this way, we may have to kill their drogue riders. Watch my signals, all right?"
"We're going to cross to Hanging Rock as part of their party?" Alain asked. He had always been a step or two behind Cuthbert, but Roland didn't mind. Sometimes reliability was better than quickness.
"Is that it?"
"If the cards fall that way, yes."
"If they've got the pink ball with them, you better hope it doesn't give us away," Alain said.
Cuthbert looked surprised. Roland bit his lip, thinking that sometimes Alain was plenty quick. Certainly he had come up with this unpleasant little idea ahead of Bert, ahead of Roland, too.
"We've got a lot to hope for this morning, but we'll play our cards as they come off the top of the pack."
They dismounted and sat by their horses there on the edge of the grass, saying little. Roland watched the silver clouds of dust racing each other across the desert floor and thought of Susan. He imagined them married, living in a freehold somewhere south of Gilead. By then Farson would have been defeated, the world's strange decline reversed. A childish part of him simply assumed that making an end to John Farson would somehow see to that. And his gunslinging days would be over. Less than a year it had been since he had won the right to carry the 6-shooters he wore on his hips, and to carry his father's great revolvers when Stephen Deschaine decided to pass them on, and already he was tired of them. Susan's kisses had softened his heart and quickened him somehow, had made another life possible. A better one, perhaps. One with a house and kiddies, and they're coming, Alain said, snapping Roland out of his reverie. The gunslinger stood up, rusher's reins in one fist. Cuthbert stood tensely nearby.
Large party or small? Do you know?
Alain stood facing southeast, hands held out with the palms up. Beyond his shoulder, Roland saw Old Star just about to slip below the horizon, only an hour until dawn then.
"I can't tell yet," Alain said.
"Can you at least tell if the ball—"
"No, shut up, Roland. Let me listen."
Roland and Cuthbert stood and watched Alain anxiously, at the same time straining their ears to hear the hooves of horses, the creak of wheels, or the murmur of men on the passing wind. Time spun out. The wind, rather than dropping as Old Star disappeared and dawn approached, blew more fiercely than ever. Roland looked at Cuthbert, who had taken out his slingshot and was playing nervously with the pole. Bert raised one shoulder in a shrug.
"It's a small party," Alain said suddenly. "Can either of you touch them?"
They shook their heads.
"No more than 10. Maybe only 6.
"Gods," Roland murmured, and pumped a fist at the sky. He couldn't help it.
"And the ball?"
"I can't touch it," Alain said. He sounded almost as though he were sleeping himself.
"But it's with them, don't you think?"
Roland did. A small party of six or eight, probably traveling with the ball. It was perfect.
"Be ready, boys," he said. "We're going to take them."
9. Jonas's party made good time down the drop and into the bad grass. The guide stars were brilliant in the autumn sky, and Renfrew knew them all. He had a click line to measure between the two he called the twins, and he stopped the group briefly every 20 minutes or so to use it. Jonas hadn't the slightest doubt the old cowboy would bring them out of the tall grass pointed straight at Hanging Rock. Then, about an hour after they'd entered the bad grass, Quint rode up beside him.
"That old lady, she want to see you, Si. She say it's important."
"Do she now?" Jonas asked.
"Aye."
Quint lowered his voice.
"That ball she got on her lap all glowy."
"Is that so?"
"I'll tell you what, Quint, keep my old trail buddies company while I see what's what."
He dropped back until he was pacing beside the black cart. Rhea raised her face to him, and for a moment, washed as it was in the pink light, he thought it the face of a young girl.
"So," she said, "here you are, big boy. I thought you'd show up pretty smart."
She cackled, and as her face broke into its sour lines of laughter, Jonas again saw her as she really was, all but sucked dry by the thing in her lap. Then he looked down at it himself and was lost. He could feel that pink glow radiating into all the deepest passages and hollows of his mind, lighting them up in a way they'd never been lit up before. Even Coral, at her dirty busiest, couldn't light him up that way.
"You like it, don't ye?" she half laughed, half crooned. "Aye, so you do. So would anyone. Such a pretty glam it is. But what do you see, Si Jonas?"
Leaning over, holding to the saddle horn with one hand, his long hair hanging down in a sheaf, Jonas looked deeply into the ball. At first he saw only that luscious labial pink, and then it began to draw apart. Now he saw a hut surrounded by tall grass, the sort of hut only a hermit could love. The door, it was painted appealing but still bright red, stood open. And sitting there on the stone stoop, with her hands in her lap, her blankets on the ground at her feet, and her unbound hair around her shoulders, was...
"I'll be damned," Jonas whispered.
He had now leaned so far out of the saddle that he looked like a trick rider in a circus show, and his eyes seemed to have disappeared. There were only sockets of pink light where they had been. Rhea cackled delightedly.
"Aye, it's Thorin's jelly that never was. Dearborn's lover girl."
Her cackling stopped abruptly.
"Lover girl of the young proddy who killed my Ermot. And he'll pay for it, aye, so he will. Look closer, Si Jonas, look closer."
He did. Everything was clear now, and he thought he should have seen it earlier. Everything this girl's aunt had feared had been true. Rhea had known, although why she hadn't told anyone the girl had been screwing one of the in-world boys, Jonas didn't know. And Susan had done more than just screw Will Dearborn. She'd helped him escape, him and his trailmates, and she might well have killed two lawmen for him into the bargain. The figure in the ball swam closer. Watching that made him feel a little dizzy, but it was a pleasant dizziness. Beyond the girl was the hut, faintly lit by a lamp which had been turned down to the barest core of flame. At first Jonas thought someone was sleeping in one corner, but on second glance he decided it was only a heap of hides that looked vaguely human.
"Do we spy the boys?"
Rhea asked, seemingly from a great distance.
"Do we spy him, my lord Si?"
"No," he said, his own voice seeming to come from that same distant place. His eyes were pinned to the ball. He could feel its light baking deeper and deeper into his brain. It was a good feeling, like a hot fire on a cold night.
"She's alone. Looks as if she's waiting." "Aye.
Rhea gestured above the ball, a curt dusting-off movement of the hands, and the pink light was gone. Jonas gave a low, protesting cry, but no matter, the ball was dark again. He wanted to stretch his hands out and tell her to make the light return, to beg her if necessary, and held himself back by pure force of will. He was rewarded by a slow return of his wits. It helped to remind himself that Rhea's gestures were as meaningless as the puppets in a Pinch and Gilly show. The ball did what it wanted, not what she wanted. Meanwhile, the ugly old woman was looking at him with eyes that were perversely shrewd and clear.
"Waiting for what, do we suppose?" she asked.
There was only one thing she could be waiting for, Jonas thought with rising alarm. The boys! The three beardless sons of bitches from Inworld! And if they weren't with her, they might well be up ahead, doing their own waiting. Waiting for him. Possibly even waiting for...
"Listen to me," he said. "I'll only speak once, and you best answer true. Do they know about that thing? Do those three boys know about the rainbow?"
Her eyes shifted away from his. It was answer enough in one way, but not in another. She had had things her way all too long up there on her hill. She had to know who was boss down here. He leaned over again and grabbed her shoulder. It was horrible, like grabbing a bare bone that somehow still lived, but he made himself hold on all the same, and squeeze. She moaned and wriggled, but he held on.
"Tell me, you old bitch! Run your fucking gob!" "They might know of it," she whined. "The girl might have seen something the night she came to me. Arr! Let go, you're killing me."
"If I wanted to kill you, you'd be dead." He took another longing glance at the ball, then sat up straight in the saddle, cupped his hands around his mouth, and called, "Clay, hold up!" As Reynolds and Renfrew reined back, Jonas raised a hand to halt the vax behind him. The wind whispered through the grass, bending it, rippling it, whipping up eddies of sweet smell. Jonas stared ahead into the dark, even though he knew it was fruitless to look for them. They could be anywhere, and Jonas didn't like the odds in an ambush, not one bit. He rode to where Clay and Renfrew were waiting. Renfrew looked impatient.
"What's the problem? Dawn'll be breaking soon. We ought to get a move on. Do you know the hut's in the bad grass?"
"Aye, most. Why, do you know one with a red door?"
Renfrew nodded and pointed northish.
"Old Sunni's place. He had some sort of religious conversion, a dream or a vision or something. That's when he painted the door of his hut red. He's gone to the Manny folk these last 5 years.
He no longer asked why, at least. He had seen something on Jonas's face that had shut up his questions. Jonas raised his hand, looked at the blue coffin tattooed there for a second, then turned and called for Quint.
"You're in charge," Jonas told him.
Quint's shaggy eyebrows shot up.
"Me?"
"Yeah, but you're not going on. There's been a change of plan."
"What? Listen, and don't open your mouth again unless there's something you don't understand. Get that damn black cart turned around. Put your men around it and hie on back the way we came. Join up with Lengel and his men. Tell them Jonas says wait where you find him until he and Reynolds and Renfrew come. Clear?"
Quint nodded. He looked bewildered, but said nothing.
"Good. Get about it. And tell the witch to put her toy back in its bag."
Jonas passed a hand over his brow. Fingers which had rarely shaken before had now picked up a minute tremble.
"It's distracting."
Quint started away, then looked back when Jonas called his name.
"I think those in-world boys are out here, Quint. Probably ahead of where we are now, but if they're back the way you're going, they'll probably set on you."
Quint looked nervously around at the grass, which rose higher than his head. Then his lips tightened and he returned his attention to Jonas.
"If they attack, they'll try to take the ball," Jonas continued. "And sigh, mark me well. Any man who doesn't die protecting it will wish he had."
He lifted his chin at the Vax, who sat astride their horses in a line behind the black cart.
Tell them that.
Aye, boss, Quint said. When you reach Langill's party, you'll be safe.
How long should we wait for you if you don't come?
Till hell freezes over. Now go.
As Quint left, Jonas turned to Reynolds and Renfrew.
We're going to make a little side trip, boys, he said.
Ten. Roland, Alain's voice was low and urgent. They've turned around.
Are you sure?
Yes. There's another group coming along behind them, a much larger one. That's where they're headed.
Safety in numbers, that's all, Cuthbert said.
Do they have the ball? Roland asked. Can you touch it yet?
Yes, they have it. It makes them easy to touch, even though they're going the other way now. Once you find it, it glows like a lamp in a mine shaft.
Does Rhea still have the keeping of it?
I think so. It's awful to touch her.
Jonas is afraid of us, Roland said. He wants more men around him when he comes. That's what it is. What it must be.
Unaware that he was both right and badly out in his reckoning. Unaware that for one of the few times since they had left Gilead, he had lapsed into a teenager's disastrous certainty.
What do we do? Alain asked.
Sit here. Listen. Wait. They'll bring the ball this way again if they're going to Hanging Rock. They'll have to.
Susan? Cuthbert asked. Susan and Shimi, what about them? How do we know they're all right?
I suppose that we don't.
Roland sat down, cross-legged, with Rusher's trailing reins in his lap. But Jonas and his men will be back soon enough, and when they come, we'll do what we must.
11. Susan hadn't wanted to sleep inside. The hut felt wrong to her without Roland. She had left Shimi huddled under the old hides in the corner and taken her own blankets outside. She sat in the hut's doorway for a little while, looking up at the stars and praying for Roland in her own fashion. When she began to feel a little better, she lay down on one blanket and pulled the other over her. It seemed an eternity since Maria had shaken her out of her heavy sleep, and the open-mouthed glottal snores drifting out of the hut didn't bother her much. She slept with her head pillowed on one arm, and didn't wake when 20 minutes later Shimi came to the doorway, blinked at her sleepily, and then walked off into the grass to urinate. The only one to notice him was Capricoso, who stuck out his long muzzle and took a nip at Shimi's butt as the boy passed him. Shimi, still mostly asleep, reached back and pushed the muzzle away. He knew Cappy's tricks well enough, so he did. Susan dreamed of the willow grove, bird and bear and hare and fish. And what woke her wasn't Shimi's return from his necessary, but a cold circle of steel pressing into her neck. There was a loud click that she recognized at once from the sheriff's office, a pistol being cocked. The willow grove faded from the eye of her mind.
"Shine, little sunbeam," said a voice.
For a moment, her bewildered, half-waking mind tried to believe it was yesterday, and Maria wanted her to get up and out of Seafront before whoever had killed Mayor Thorin and Chancellor Reimer could come back and kill her as well. No good. It wasn't the strong light of mid-morning that her eyes opened upon, but the ash-pallid glow of 5 o'clock. Not a woman's voice, but a man's, and not a hand shaking her shoulder, but the barrel of a gun against her neck. She looked up and saw a lined, narrow face framed by white hair, lips no more than a scar, eyes the same faded blue as Roland's. Eldred Jonas. The man standing behind him had bought her own dad drinks once upon a happier time, Hash Renfrew. A third man, one of Jonas's cottet, ducked into the hut. Freezing terror filled her midsection, some for her, some for Shimi. She wasn't sure the boy would even understand what was happening to them. These are two of the three men who tried to kill him, she thought. He'll understand that much.
Here you are, Sunbeam. Here you come, Jonas said companionably, watching her blink away the sleep fog. Good. You shouldn't be napping all the way out here on your own, not a pretty size such as yourself. But don't worry, I'll see you get back to where you belong.
His eyes flicked up as the redhead with the cloak stepped out of the hut. Alone?
What you got in there, Clay? Anything?
Reynolds shook his head.
All still on the horse, I reckon.
Shimi, Susan thought. Where are you, Shimi? Jonas reached out and caressed one of her breasts briefly.
Nice, he said, tender and sweet. No wonder Dearborn likes you.
Get your filthy blue-marked hand off me, you bastard!
Smiling, Jonas did as she bid. He turned his head and regarded the mule.
I know this one. It belongs to my good friend Coral, along with everything else you've turned livestock thief. Shameful, shameful, this younger generation, don't you agree, Sire Renfrew?
But her father's old associate said nothing. His face was carefully blank, and Susan thought he might be just the tiniest tad ashamed of his presence here. Jonas turned back to her, his thin lips curved in the semblance of a benevolent smile.
Well, after murder, I suppose stealing a mule comes easy, don't it?
She said nothing, only watched as Jonas stroked Cappy's muzzle.
What all were they hauling, those boys, that it took a mule to put it on?
Shrouds, she said through numb lips, for you and all your friends. A fearful heavy load it made, too, near broke the poor animal's back.
There's a saying in the land I come from, Jonas said, still smiling. Clever girls go to hell. Ever heard it?
He went on stroking Cappy's nose. The mule liked it. His neck was thrust out to its full length, his stupid little eyes half closed with pleasure.
Has it crossed your mind that fellas who unload their pack animals, split up what it was carrying, and take the goods away, usually ain't coming back?
Susan said nothing.
You've been left high and dry, Sunbeam. Fast fucked is usually fast forgot, sad to say. Do you know where they went?
Yes, she said.
Her voice was low, barely a whisper. Jonas looked pleased.
If he was to tell, things might go easier for you. Would you agree, Renfrew?
Aye, Renfrew said. They're traitors, Susan, for the good man. If you know where they are or what they're up to, tell us.
Keeping her eyes fixed on Jonas, Susan said, "Come closer." Her numbed lips didn't want to move, and it came out sounding like "Come closer," but Jonas understood and leaned forward, stretching his neck in a way that made him look absurdly like Capricoso. When he did, Susan spat in his face. Jonas recoiled, lips twisting in surprise and revulsion.
"Arr, bitch!"
he cried, and launched a full-swung, open-handed blow that drove her to the ground. She landed at full length on her side, with black stars exploding across her field of vision. She could already feel her right cheek swelling like a balloon, and thought if he'd hit an inch or two lower, he might have broken my neck. Mayhap that would have been best. She raised her hand to her nose and wiped blood from the right nostril. Jonas turned to Renfrew, who had taken a single step forward and then stopped himself.
Put her on her horse and tie her hands in front of her. Tight!
He looked down at Susan, then kicked her in the shoulder hard enough to send her rolling toward the hut.
Spit on me, would you? Spit on Elder Jonas, would you, you bitch?
Reynolds was holding out his neckerchief. Jonas took it, wiped the spittle from his face with it, then dropped into a hunker beside her. He took a handful of her hair and carefully wiped the neckerchief with it. Then he hauled her to her feet. Tears of pain now peeped from the corners of her eyes, but she kept silent.
I may never see your friend again, sweet Sue, with the tender little titties, but I've got you, ain't I? Yeah.
And if Dearborn gives us trouble, I'll give you double. And make sure Dearborn knows you may count on it."
His smile faded, and he gave her a sudden, bitter shove that almost sent her sprawling again.
"Now get mounted, and do it before I decide to change your face a little with my knife."
12. Shimi watched from the grass, terrified and silently crying, as Susan spit in the bad coffin hunter's face and was knocked to the ground, hit so hard the blow might have killed her. He almost rushed out then, but something, it could have been his friend Arthur's voice in his head, told him that would only get him killed. He watched as Susan mounted. One of the other men, not a coffin hunter, but a big rancher Shimi had seen in the rest from time to time, tried to help, but Susan pushed him away with the sole of her boot. The man stood back with a red face.
"Don't make him mad, Susan," Shimi thought. "Oh, gods, don't do that. They'll hit you some more. Oh, your poor face. And you got a nosebleed, so you do."
"Last chance," Jonas told her.
"Where are they, and what do they mean to do?"
"Go to hell," she said.
He smiled, a thin, hurty smile.
"Likely I'll find you there when I arrive," he said.
Then, to the other coffin hunter, "You check the place careful?"
"Whatever they had, they took it," the redhead answered. "Only thing they left was Dearborn's punch bunny."
That made Jonas laugh meany-mean as he climbed on board his own horse.
"Come on," he said. "Let's ride."
They went back into the bad grass. It closed around them, and it was as if they had never been there, except that Susan was gone, and so was Cappy. The big rancher riding beside Susan had been leading the mule. When he was sure they weren't going to return, Shimi walked slowly back into the clearing, doing up the button on top of his pants as he came. He looked from the way Roland and his friends had gone to the one in which Susan had been taken. Which? A moment's thought made him realize there was no choice. The grass out here was tough and springy. The path Roland and Elaine and good old Arthur Heath, so Shimi still thought of him and always would, had taken, was gone. The one made by Susan and her captors, on the other hand, was still clear, and perhaps if he followed her, he could do something for her, help her. Walking at first, then jogging, as his fear that they might double back and catch him dissipated, Shimi went in the direction Susan had been taken. He would follow her most of that day. 13. Cuthbert, not the most sanguine of personalities in any situation, grew more and more impatient as the day brightened toward true dawn. "It's reaping," he thought, "finally reaping, and here we sit with our knives sharpened and not a thing in the world to cut." Twice he asked Elaine what he heard. The first time Elaine only grunted. The second time he asked what Bert expected him to hear was someone yapping away in his ear like that. Cuthbert, who did not consider two inquiries 15 minutes apart as yapping away, wandered off and sat morosely in front of his horse. After a bit, Roland came over and sat down beside him. "Waiting," Cuthbert said. "That's what most of our time in Magus has been about, and it's the thing I do worst." "You won't have to do it much longer," Roland said. 14. Jonas's company reached the place where Fran Lengel's party had made a temporary camp about an hour after the sun had topped the horizon. Quint, Rhea, and Renfrew's Vax were already there and drinking coffee, Jonas was glad to see. Lengel started forward, saw Susan riding with her hands tied, and actually drew back a step, as if he wanted to find a corner to hide in. There were no corners out here, however, so he stood fast. He did not look happy about it, however. Susan nudged her horse forward with her knees, and when Reynolds tried to grab her shoulder, she dipped it to the side, temporarily eluding him.
"Why, Francis Lengel, imagine meeting you here."
"Susan, I'm sorry to see you so," Lengel said.
His flush crept closer and closer to his brow, like a tide approaching a seawall.
"It's bad company you've fallen in with, girl, and in the end bad company always leaves you to face the music alone."
Susan actually laughed.
"Bad company," she said. "Ah, you'd know about that, wouldn't you, Fran?"
He turned, awkward and stiff in his embarrassment. She raised one booted foot, and before anyone could stop her, kicked him squarely between the shoulder blades. He went down on his stomach, his whole face widening in shocked surprise.
"No, you don't, you bold cunt!"
Renfrew shouted, and fetched her a wallop to the side of the head. It was on the left, and at least evened things up a bit, she would think later, when her mind cleared and she was capable of thinking. She swayed in the saddle, but kept her seat. And she never looked at Renfrew, only at Lengil, who had now managed to get to his hands and knees. He wore a deeply dazed expression.
"You killed my father!" she screamed at him. "You killed my father, you cowardly, sneaking excuse for a man!"
She looked at the party of ranchers and Vax, all of them staring at her now.
"There he is, Fran Lengil, head of the Horsemen's Association, as low as sneak as ever walked, low as coyote shit, low as—"
"That's enough," Jonas said, watching with some interest as Lengil scuttled back to his men. And yes, Susan was bitterly delighted to see it was a full-fledged scuttle, with his shoulders hunched. Rhea was cackling, rocking from side to side, and making a sound like fingernails on a piece of slate. The sound shocked Susan, but she wasn't a bit surprised by Rhea's presence in this company.
"It could never be enough," she said,
looking from Jonas to Lengil with an expression of contempt so deep it seemed bottomless.
"For him it could never be enough."
"Well, perhaps. But you did quite well in the time you had, Lady Sai. Few could have done better. And listen to the witch cackle, like salt in his wounds, I wot. But we'll shut her up soon enough." Then, turning his head, "Clay?" Reynolds rode up. "Think you can get Sunbeam back to Seafront all right?"
"I think so."
Reynolds tried not to show the relief he felt at being sent back east instead of west. He had begun to have a bad feeling about Hanging Rock, Latigo, the tankers, about the whole show, really. God knew why.
"Now?"
"Give it another minute," Jonas said. "Mayhap there's going to be a spot of killing right here. Who knows? But it's the unanswered questions that makes it worthwhile getting up in the morning, even when a man's leg aches like a tooth with a hole in it, wouldn't you say so?"
"I don't know, Aldred."
"Sai Renfrew, watch our pretty Sunbeam a minute. I have a piece of property to take back." His voice carried well, he had meant that it should, and Rhea's cackles cut off suddenly, as if severed out of her throat with a hooking knife. Smiling, Jonas walked his horse toward the black cart with its jostling show of gold symbols. Reynolds rode on his left, and Jonas sensed rather than saw DePape fall in on his right. Roy was a good enough boy, really. His head was a little soft, but his heart was in the right place, and you didn't have to tell him everything. For every step forward Jonas's horse took, Rhea shrank back a little in the cart. Her eyes shifted from side to side in their deep sockets, looking for a way out that wasn't there.
"Keep away from me, you chary man," she cried, raising a hand toward him.
With the other, she clutched the sack with the ball in it ever more tightly.
"Keep away, or I'll bring the lightning and strike you dead where you sit your horse. Your hairier friends, too."
Jonas thought Roy hesitated briefly at that, but Clay never did, nor did Jonas himself. He guessed there was a great lot she could do, or that there had been at one time. But that was before the hungry glass had entered her life. "Give it up to me," he said. He reached the side of her wagon and held his hand out for the bag. "It's not yours and never was. One day you'll doubtless have the good man's thanks for keeping it so well as you have, but now you must give it up." She screamed, a sound of such piercing intensity that several of the vaqueros dropped their tin coffee cups and clapped their hands over their ears. At the same time, she nodded her hand through the drawstring and raised the bag over her head. The curved shape of the ball swung back and forth at the bottom of it like a pendulum.
"I'll not," she howled. "I'll smash it on the ground before I give it up to the likes of you."
Jonas doubted if the ball would break, not hurled by her weak arms onto the trampled, springy mat of the bad grass, but he didn't think he would have occasion to find out one way or the other.
"Clay," he said, "draw your gun."
He didn't need to look at Clay to see that he'd done it. He saw the frantic way her eyes shifted to the left where Clay sat his horse.
"I'm going to have a count," Jonas said. "Just a short one. If I get to three and she hasn't passed that bag over, blow her ugly head off."
"Aye."
"One," Jonas said, watching the ball pendulum back and forth at the bottom of the upheld bag. It was glowing. He could see dull pink even through the cloth.
"Two. Enjoy hell, Rhea. Goodbye."
"Three here!" she screamed, thrusting it out toward him and shielding her face with the crooked hook of her free hand.
"Here, take it, and may it damn you the way it's damned me."
"Thank you, Si." He grabbed the bag just below the draw top and yanked. Rhea screamed again as the string skinned her knuckles and tore off one of her nails. Jonas hardly heard. His mind was a white explosion of exultation. For the first time in his long professional life, he forgot his job, his surroundings, and the 6,000 things that could get him killed on any day. He had it. He had it. By all the graves of all the gods, he had the fucking thing.
"Mine,"
he thought, and that was all. He somehow restrained the urge to open the bag and stick his head inside it, like a horse sticking its head into a bag of oats, and looped the drawstring over the pommel of his saddle twice instead. He took in a breath as deep as his lungs would allow, then expelled it.
"Better. A little."
"Roy? Aye, Jonas?"
It would be good to get out of this place, Jonas thought, and not for the first time, to get away from these hicks. He was sick of I and ye, and so it is, sick to his bones.
"Roy, we'll give the bitch a 10 count this time. If she isn't out of my sight by then, you have my permission to blow her ass off. Now, let's see if you can do the counting. I'll be listening close, so mind you don't skip any."
"One," DePape said eagerly. "Two, three... 4. Spitting curses, Rhea snatched up the reins of the cart and spanked the pony's back with them. The pony laid its ears back and jerked the cart forward so vigorously that Rhea went tumbling backward off the cantboard, her feet up, her white and bony shins showing above her ankle-high black shoes and mismatched wool stockings. The vaqueros laughed. Jonas laughed himself. It was pretty funny, all right, seeing her on her back with her pins in the air.
5,
DePape said, laughing so hard he was hiccuping.
6.
Rhea climbed back up, flopped onto the cantboard again with all the grace of a dying fish, and peered around at them, wall-eyed and sneering.
"I curse ye all,"
she screamed. It cut through them, stilling their laughter, even as the cart bounced toward the edge of the trampled clearing.
"Every last one of ye! Ye and ye and ye!"
Her crooked finger pointed last at Jonas.
"Thief! Miserable thief!"
"As though it was yours," Jonas marveled, although "mine" was the first word to occur to him once he had taken possession of it.
"As though such a wonder could ever belong to a backcountry reader of rooster gut such as you."
The cart bounced its way into the bad grass, the pony pulling hard with its ears laid back. The old woman's scream served to drive it better than any whip could have done. The black slipped into the green. They saw the cart flicker like a conjurer's trick, and then it was gone. For a long time yet, however, they heard her shrieking her curses, calling death down upon them beneath the demon moon. XV.
"Go on," Jonas told Clay Reynolds. "Take our sunbeam back. And if you want to stop on the way and make some use of her, why, be my guest."
He glanced at Susan as he said this to see what effect it might be having. But he was disappointed. She looked dazed, as if the last blow Renfrew had dealt her had scrambled her brains, at least temporarily.
Just make sure she gets to Coral at the end of all the fun.
I will.
Any message for Cythorin? Tell her to keep the wench someplace safe until she hears from me. And why don't you stay with her, Clay? Coral, I mean. Come tomorrow, I don't think we'll have to worry about this one anymore. But Coral, ride with her to Ritzy when she goes. Be her escort-like.
Reynolds nodded. Better and better. Seafront it would be, and that was fine. He might like a little taste of the girl once he got her there, but not on the way. Not under the ghostly full daytime demon moon.
Go on then, get started.
Reynolds led her across the clearing, aiming for a point well away from the bent swath of grass where Rhea had made her exit. Susan rode silently, downcast eyes fixed on her bound wrists. Jonas turned to face his men.
The three young fellas from Inworld have broken their way out of jail with that haughty young bitch's help, he said, pointing at Susan's departing back.
There was a low, growling murmur from the men. That Will Dearborn and his friends were free, they had known. That Cy Delgado had helped them escape, they had not. And it was perhaps just as well for her that Reynolds was at that moment leading her into the bad grass and out of sight.
Never mind, Jonas shouted, pulling their attention back to him.
He reached out a stealthy hand and caressed the curve at the bottom of the drawstring bag. Just touching the ball made him feel as if he could do anything, and with one hand tied behind his back at that.
Never mind her and never mind them.
His eyes moved from Lengel to Wertner to Croydon to Brian Hookey to Roy DePape.
We're close to 40 men, going to join another 150. They're three, and not one a day over 16. Are you afraid of three little boys?
No, they cried.
If we run on them, my cullies, what will we do?
Kill them! The shout so loud that it sent rooks rising up into the morning sun, cawing their displeasure as they commenced the hunt for more peaceful surroundings. Jonas was satisfied. His hand was still on the sweet curve of the ball, and he could feel it pouring strength into him. Pink strength, he thought, and grinned.
Come on, boys. I want those tankers in the woods west of Eyebolt before the home folks light their reap night bonfire.
16. Shimi, crouched down in the grass and peering into the clearing, was nearly run over by Rhea's black wagon. The screaming, gibbering witch passed so close to him that he could smell her sour skin and dirty hair. If she had looked down, she couldn't have missed seeing him, and undoubtedly would have turned him into a bird or a bumbler, or maybe even a mosquito. The boy saw Jonas pass custody of Susan to the one in the cloak, and began working his way around the edge of the clearing. He heard Jonas haranguing the men, many of whom Shimi knew. It shamed him to know how many Magus cowboys were doing that bad coffin hunter's bidding, but paid no attention to what he was saying. Shimi froze in place as they mounted up, momentarily scared they would come in his direction. But they rode the other way, west. The clearing emptied almost as if by magic. Except it wasn't entirely empty. Capricoso had been left behind, his lead trailing on the beaten grass. Cappy looked after the departing riders, brayed once, as if to tell them they could all go to hell, then turned and made eye contact with Shimi, who was peering out into the clearing. The mule flicked his ears at the boy and tried to graze. He lipped the bad grass a single time, raised his head, and brayed at Shimi as if to say this was all the inn-boy's fault. Shimi stared thoughtfully at Capricoso, thinking of how much easier it was to ride than to walk. Gods, yes. But that second bray decided him against it. The mule might give one of his disgusted cries at the wrong time and alert the man who had Susan.
You'll find your way home, I reckon, Shimi said. So long, pal. So long, good old Cappy. See you farther down the path.
He found the path made by Susan and Reynolds and began to trot after them once more. 17. They're coming again, Alain said, a moment before Roland sensed it himself, a brief flicker in his head like pink lightning. All of them. Roland hunkered in front of Cuthbert. Cuthbert looked back at him without even a suggestion of his usual foolish good humor. "Much of it's on you," Roland said, then tapped the slingshot. "And on that." "I know. How much have you got in the armory?" "Almost 4 dozen steel balls." Bert held up a cotton bag, which had in more settled times held his father's tobacco. "Plus assorted fireworks in my saddlebag." "How many big bangers?" "Enough, Roland." Unsmiling. With the laughter gone from them, he had the hollow eyes of just one more killer. "Enough." Roland ran a hand down the front of the serape he wore, letting his palm reacquaint itself with the rough weave. He looked at Cuthbert's, then at a lens, telling himself again that it could work, yes, as long as they held their nerve and didn't let themselves think of it in terms of 3 against 40 or 50. It could work. "The ones out at Hanging Rock will hear the shooting once it starts, won't they?" Al asked. Roland nodded. "With the wind blowing from us to them, there's no doubt of that." "We'll have to move fast, then." "We'll go as best we can." Roland thought of standing between the tangled green hedges behind the great hall, David the hawk on his arm, and a sweat of terror trickling down his back. "I think you die today," he had told the hawk, and he had told it true. Yet he himself had lived and passed his test and walked out of the testing corridor facing east. Today it was Cuthbert and Alain's turn to be tested, not in Gilead, in the traditional place of proving behind the Great Hall, but here in Magus, on the edge of the Badgrass, in the desert, and in the canyon. Eyebolt Canyon. "Prove or die," Alain said, as if reading the run of the gunslinger's thoughts. "That's what it comes down to." "Yes. That's what it always comes down to in the end." "How long before they get here, do you think?" "An hour, at least, I'd say. Likely 2. They'll be running a watch and go." Alain nodded. "I think so, yes." "That's not good," Cuthbert said. "Jonas is afraid of being ambushed in the grass," Roland said. "Maybe of us setting fire to it around him. They'll loosen up when they get into the clear." "You hope," Cuthbert said. Roland nodded gravely. "Yes, I hope." XVIII. At first, Reynolds was content to lead the girl along the broken back trail at a fast walk. But about 30 minutes after leaving Jonas, Lengil, and the rest, he broke into a trot. Pylon matched Reynolds's horse easily, and just as easily when 10 minutes later he upped their speed to a light but steady run. Susan held to the horn of her saddle with her bound hands and rode easily at Reynolds's right, her hair streaming out behind her. She thought her face must be quite colorful. The skin of her cheeks felt raised at least 2 inches higher than usual, welted and tender. Even the passing wind stung a little. At the place where the bad grass gave way to the drop, Reynolds stopped to give the horses a blow. He dismounted himself, turned his back to her, and took a piss. As he did, Susan looked up along the rise of land and saw the great herd, now untended and unraveling at the edges. They had done that much, perhaps. It wasn't much, but it was something. "Do you need to do the necessary?" Reynolds asked. "I'll help you down if you do, but don't say no now and whine about it later." "Ye're afraid. Big, brave regulator that ye are. Ye're scared, ain't ye? Aye. Coffin, tattoo, and all." Reynolds tried a contemptuous grin. It didn't fit his face very well this morning.
"You ought to leave the fortune-telling to those that are good at it, missy. Now, do you need a necessary stop or not?"
"No. And ye are afraid." "Of what?"
Reynolds, who only knew that his bad feeling hadn't left him when he left Jonas, as he'd hoped it would, bared his tobacco-stained teeth at her.
"If you can't talk sensible, just shut up."
"Why don't you let me go? Perhaps my friends will do the same for you when they catch us up."
This time Reynolds grunted laughter, which was almost genuine. He swung himself into his saddle, hawked, spat.
Overhead, Demon Moon was a pale and bloated ball in the sky.
"You can dream, Miss Sai," he said. "Dreamin's free. But you ain't never gonna see those three again. They're for the worms, they are. Now let's ride." They rode.
19. Cordelia hadn't gone to bed at all on Reaping Eve. She sat the night through in her parlor chair, and although there was sewing on her lap, she had not put a single stitch in nor picked one out. Now, as morning's light brightened toward 10 o'clock, she sat in the same chair, looking out at nothing. What was there to look at, anyway? Everything had come down with a smash. All her hopes of the fortune Thorin would settle on Susan and Susan's child, perhaps while he still lived, certainly in his dead letter. All her hopes of ascending to her proper place in the community, all her plans for the future, swept away by two willful young people who couldn't keep their pants up. She sat in her old chair with her knitting on her lap and the ashes Susan had smeared on her cheeks standing out like a brand, and thought, "They'll find me dead in this chair some day, old, poor, and forgotten, that ungrateful child, after all I did for her." What roused her was a weak scratching at the window. She had no idea how long it had been going on before it finally intruded on her consciousness, but when it did, she laid her needlework aside and got up to see. A bird, perhaps, or children playing reaping jokes, unaware that the world had come to an end. Whatever it was, she would shoo it away. Cordelia saw nothing at first. Then, as she was about to turn away, she spied a pony and cart at the edge of the yard. The cart was a little disquieting, black, with gold symbols overpainted, and the pony in the shaft stood with its head lowered, not grazing, looking as if it had been run half to death. She was still frowning out at this when a twisted, filthy hand rose in the air directly in front of her and began to scratch at the glass again. Cordelia gasped and clapped both hands to her bosom as her heart took a startled leap in her chest. She backed up a step and gave a little shriek as her calf brushed the fender of the stove. The long, dirty nails scratched twice more, then fell away. Cordelia stood where she was for a moment, irresolute, then went to the door, stopping at the wood box to pick up a chunk of ash which fitted her hand. Just in case. Then she jerked the door open, went to the corner of the house, drew in a deep, steadying breath, and went around to the garden side, raising the ash chunk as she did.
"Get out, whoever you are! Scat, before I—"
Her voice was stilled by what she saw. An incredibly old woman crawling through the frost-killed flower bed next to the house, crawling toward her. The crone's stringy white hair, what remained of it, hung in her face. Sores festered on her cheeks and brow. Her lips had split and drizzled blood down her pointed, warty chin. The corneas of her eyes had gone a filthy gray-yellow, and she panted like a cracked bellows as she moved.
"Good woman, help me," the spectre gasped. "Help me, if you will, for I'm about done up."
The hand holding the chunk of ash sagged. Cordelia could hardly believe what she was seeing.
"Rhea?" she whispered. "Is it Rhea?"
"Why?"
Rhea whispered, crawling relentlessly through the dead silk flowers, dragging her hands through the cold earth.
"Help me."
Cordelia retreated a step, her makeshift bludgeon now hanging at her knee.
"No, I can't have such as thee in my house. I'm sorry to see you so, but I have a reputation, ye ken. Folk watch me close, so they do."
She glanced at the high street as she said this, as if expecting to see a line of townspeople outside her gate, watching eagerly, avid to fleet their wretched gossip on its lying way. But there was no one there. Ambry was quiet, its walks and byways empty, the customary joyous noise of reaping fair day stilled. She looked back at the thing which had fetched up in her dead flowers.
"Your niece did this,"
the thing in the dirt whispered.
"All her fault."
Cordelia dropped the chunk of wood. It clipped the side of her ankle, but she hardly noticed. Her hands curled into fists before her.
"Help me,"
Rhea whispered.
"I know where she is. We have work, us two. Women's work."
Cordelia hesitated a moment, then went to the woman, knelt, got an arm around her, and somehow got her to her feet. The smell coming off her was reeky and nauseating, the smell of decomposing flesh. Bony fingers caressed Cordelia's cheek and the side of her neck as she helped the hag into the house. Cordelia's flesh crawled, but she didn't pull away until Rhea collapsed into a chair, gasping from one end and farting from the other.
"Listen to me," the old woman hissed.
"I am." Cordelia drew a chair over and sat beside her. At death's door, she might be, but once her eye fell on you, it was strangely hard to look away. Now Rhea's fingers dipped inside the bodice of her dirty dress, brought out a silver charm of some kind, and began to move it back and forth rapidly, as if telling beads. Cordelia, who hadn't felt sleepy all night, began to feel that way now.
"The others are beyond us," Rhea said, "and the ball has slipped my grasp. But she, back to Mayor's house she's been ta'en, and mayhap we could see to her. We could do that much, aye."
"You can't see to anything," Cordelia said distantly. "You're dying." Rhea wheezed laughter and a trickle of yellowish drool.
"Dying, nay, just done up and in need of a refreshment. Now listen to me, Cordelia, daughter of Hiram and sister of Pat."
She hooked a bony and surprisingly strong arm around Cordelia's neck and drew her close. At the same time, she raised her other hand, twirling the silver medallion in front of Cordelia's wide eyes. The crone whispered, and after a bit, Cordelia began to nod her understanding.
"Do it, then,"
the old woman said, letting go. She slumped back in her chair, exhausted.
"Now, for I can't last much longer as I am, and I'll need a bit of time after, mind ye, to revive, like."
Cordelia moved across the room to the kitchen area. There, on the counter beside the hand pump, was a wooden block in which were sheathed the two sharp knives of the house. She took one and came back. Her eyes were distant and far, as Susan's had been when she and Rhea stood in the open doorway of Rhea's hut in the light of the kissing moon.
"Would ye pay her back?"
Rhea asked.
"For that's why I've come to ye."
"Miss Elf so young and pretty,"
Cordelia murmured in a barely audible voice. The hand not holding the knife floated up to her face and touched her ash-smeared cheek.
"Yes, I'd be repaid of her, so I would."
"To the death?"
"Aye, hers or mine."
"'Twill be hers," Rhea said. "Never fear it. Now, refresh me, Cordelia. Give me what I need."
Cordelia unbuttoned her dress down the front, pushing it open to reveal an ungenerous bosom and a middle which had begun to curve out in the last year or so, making a tidy little potbelly. Yet she still had the vestige of a waist, and it was here she used the knife, cutting through her shift and the top layers of flesh beneath. The white cotton began to bloom red at once along the slit.
"Aye," Rhea whispered, "like roses. I dream of them often enough, roses in bloom, and what stands black among them at the end of the world. Come closer."
She put her hand on the small of Cordelia's back, urging her forward. She raised her eyes to Cordelia's face, then grinned and licked her lips.
Good. Good enough.
Cordelia looked blankly over the top of the old woman's head as Rhea of the Coos buried her face against the red cut in the shift and began to drink. 20. Roland was at first pleased as the muted jingle of harness and buckle drew closer to the place where the three of them were hunkered down in the high grass, but as the sounds drew closer still, close enough to hear murmuring voices as well as soft thudding hooves, he began to be afraid. For the riders to pass close was one thing, but if they were through foul luck to come right upon them, the three boys would likely die like a nest of moles uncovered by the blade of a passing plow. Kaa surely hadn't brought them all this way to end in such fashion, had it? In all these miles of bad grass, how could that party of oncoming riders possibly strike the one point where Roland and his friends had pulled up? But still they closed in, the sound of tack and buckle and men's voices growing ever sharper. Alain looked at Roland with dismayed eyes and pointed to the left. Roland shook his head and patted his hands toward the ground, indicating they would stay put. They had to stay put. It was too late to move without being heard. Roland drew his guns. Cuthbert and Alain did the same. In the end, the plow missed the moles by 60 feet. The boys could actually see the horses and riders flashing through the thick grass. Roland easily made out that the party was led by Jonas, De Pape, and Lengel, riding 3 abreast. They were followed by at least 3 dozen others, glimpsed as roan flashes and the bright red and green of serapes through the grass. They were strung out pretty well, and Roland thought he and his friends could reasonably hope they'd string out even more once they reached open desert. The boys waited for the party to pass, holding their horses' heads in case one of them took it in mind to wicker a greeting to the nag so close by. When they were gone, Roland turned his pale and unsmiling face to his friends. "Mount up," he said. "Reaping's come." 21. They walked their horses to the edge of the bad grass, meeting the path of Jonas's party where the grass gave way first to a zone of stunted bushes and then to the desert itself. The wind howled high and lonesome, carrying big drifts of gritty dust under a cloudless dark blue sky. Demon moon stared down from it like the filmed eye of a corpse. 200 yards ahead, the drogue riders backing Jonas's party were spread out in a line of 3, their sombreros jammed down tight on their heads, their shoulders hunched, their serapes blowing. Roland moved so that Cuthbert rode in the middle of their trio. Bert had his slingshot in his hand. Now he handed Alain 6 steel balls and Roland 6. Then he raised his eyebrows questioningly. Roland nodded, and they began to ride. Dust blew past them in rattling sheets, sometimes turning the drogue riders into ghosts, sometimes obscuring them completely. But the boys closed in steadily. Roland rode tense, waiting for one of the drogues to turn in his saddle and see them, but none did. None of them wanted to put his face into that cutting, grit-filled wind. Nor was there sound to warn them. There was sandy hardpack under the horse's hooves now, and it didn't give away much. When they were just 20 yards behind the drogues, Cuthbert nodded. They were close enough for him to work. Alain handed him a ball. Bert, sitting ramrod straight in the saddle, dropped it into the cup of his slingshot, pulled, waited for the wind to drop, then released. The rider ahead on the left jerked as if stung, raised one hand a little, then toppled out of his saddle. Incredibly, neither of his 2 compañeros seemed to notice. Roland saw what he thought was the beginning of a reaction from the one on the right when Bert drew again and the rider in the middle collapsed forward onto his horse's neck. The horse, startled, reared up. The rider flopped bonelessly backward, his sombrero tumbling off, and fell. The wind dropped enough for Roland to hear his knee snap as his foot caught in one of his stirrups.
The third rider now began to turn. Roland caught a glimpse of a bearded face, a dangling cigarette unlit because of the wind, one astonished eye, and then Cuthbert's sling thumped again. The astonished eye was replaced by a red socket. The rider slid from his saddle, groping for the horn and missing it. Three gone, Roland thought. He kicked Rusher into a gallop. The others did the same, and the boys rode forward into the dust, a stirrup's width apart. The horses of the ambushed drogue riders veered off to the south in a group, and that was good. Riderless horses ordinarily didn't raise eyebrows in Magus, but when they were saddled... More riders up ahead. A single, then two side by side, then another single. Roland drew his knife and rode up beside the fellow who was now drogue and didn't know it. "What news?" he asked conversationally, and when the man turned, Roland buried his knife in his chest. The Vax's brown eyes widened above the bandana he'd pulled up, outlaw style, over his mouth and nose, and then he tumbled from his saddle. Cuthbert and Alain spurred past him, and Bert, not slowing, took the two riding ahead with his slingshot. The fellow beyond them heard something, in spite of the wind, and swiveled in his saddle. Alain had drawn his own knife and now held it by the tip of the blade. He threw hard in the exaggerated full-arm motion they had been taught, and although the range was long for such work, 20 feet at least, and in windy air, his aim was true. The hilt came to rest, protruding from the center of the man's bandana. The Vac groped for it, making choked, gargling sounds around the knife in his throat, and then he too dropped from the saddle. 7 now. Like the story of the shoemaker and the flies, Roland thought. His heart was beating slow and hard in his chest as he caught up with Alain and Cuthbert. The wind gusted a lonely whine. Dust flew, swirled, then dropped with the wind. Ahead of them were three more riders, and ahead of them the main party. Roland pointed at the next three, then mimed the slingshot, pointed beyond them, and mimed firing a revolver. Cuthbert and Alain nodded. They rode forward, once again stirrup to stirrup, closing in. 22. Bert got two of the three ahead of them clean, but the third jerked at the wrong moment, and the steel ball meant for the back of his head only clipped his earlobe on the way by. Roland had drawn his gun by then, however, and put a bullet in the man's temple as he turned. That made 10, a full quarter of Jonas's company before the riders even realized trouble had begun. Roland had no idea if it would be enough of an advantage, but he knew that the first part of the job was done. No more stealth. Now it was a matter of raw killing. "Heil! Heil!" he screamed in a ringing, carrying voice. "To me, gunslingers! To me! Ride them down! No prisoners!" They spurred toward the main party, riding into battle for the first time, closing like wolves on sheep, shooting before the men ahead of them had any slight idea of who had gotten in behind them or what was happening. The three boys had been trained as gunslingers, and what they lacked in experience, they made up for with the keen eyes and reflexes of the young. Under their guns, the desert east of Hanging Rock became a killing floor. Screaming, not a single thought among them above the wrists of their deadly hands, they sliced into the unprepared Magus party like a three-sided blade, shooting as they went. Not every shot killed, but not a one went entirely wild either. Men flew out of their saddles and were dragged by boots caught in stirrups as their horses bolted. Other men, some dead, some only wounded, were trampled beneath the feet of their panicky, rearing mounts. Roland rode with both guns drawn and firing, Rusher's reins gripped in his teeth so they wouldn't fall over side and trip the horse up. Two men dropped beneath his fire on his left, two more on the right. Ahead of them, Brian Hookey turned in his saddle, his beard stubbly face long with amazement. Around his neck a reap charm in the shape of a bell swung and tinkled as he grabbed for the shotgun which hung in a scabbard over one burly blacksmith's shoulder. Before he could do more than get a hand on the gunstock, Roland blew the silver bell off his chest and exploded the heart which lay beneath it. Hookey pitched out of his saddle with a grunt. Cuthbert caught up with Roland on the right side and shot two more men off their horses. He gave Roland a fierce and blazing grin. "Al was right," he shouted. "These are hard calibers."
Roland's talented fingers did their work, rolling the cylinders of the guns he held and reloading at a full gallop, doing it with a ghastly, supernatural speed and then beginning to fire again. Now they had come almost all the way through the group, riding hard, laying men low on both sides and straight ahead as well. Alain dropped back a little and turned his horse, covering Roland and Cuthbert from behind. Roland saw Jonas, de Pape, and Lengel reining around to face their attackers. Lengel was clawing at his machine gun, but the strap had gotten tangled in the wide collar of the duster he wore, and every time he grabbed for the stock, it bobbed out of his reach. Beneath his heavy, gray-blonde mustache, Lengel's mouth was twisted with fury. Now, riding between Roland and Cuthbert and these three, holding a huge, blued steel five-shot in one hand, came Hash Renfrew.
"God damn you!" Renfrew cried. "Oh, you rotten sister-fuckers!"
He dropped his reins and laid the five-shot in the crook of one elbow to steady it. The wind gusted viciously, wrapping him in an envelope of swirling brown grit. Roland had no thought of retreating or perhaps jigging to one side or the other. He had, in fact, no thoughts at all. The fever had descended over his mind, and he burned with it like a torch inside a glass sleeve. Screaming through the reins caught in his teeth, he galloped toward Hash Renfrew and the three men behind him. 23. Jonas had no clear idea of what was happening until he heard Will Dearborn screaming, "Heil to me! No prisoners!" a battle cry he knew of old. Then it fell into place, and the rattle of gunfire made sense. He reined around, aware of Roy doing the same beside him, but most aware of the ball in its bag, a thing both powerful and fragile, swinging back and forth against the neck of his horse.
"It's those kids!" Roy exclaimed. His total surprise made him look more stupid than ever.
"Dearborn, you bastard!"
Hash Renfrew spat, and the gun in his hand thundered a single time. Jonas saw Dearborn's sombrero rise from his head, its brim chewed away. Then the kid was firing, and he was good, better than anyone Jonas had ever seen in his life. Renfrew was hammered back out of his saddle with both legs kicking, still holding onto his monster gun, firing it twice at the dusty blue sky before hitting the ground on his back and rolling dead on his side. Langill's hand dropped away from the elusive wire stock of his speed shooter, and he only stared, unable to believe the apparition bearing down on him out of the dust.
"Get back!" he cried. "In the name of the Horsemen's Association, I tell you—"
Then a large black hole appeared in the center of his forehead, just above the place where his eyebrows tangled together. His hands flew up to his shoulders, palms out, as if he were declaring surrender. That was how he died.
"Son of a bitch! Oh, you little sister fucking son of a bitch!"
De Pape howled. He tried to draw, and his revolver got caught in his serape. He was still trying to pull it free when a bullet from Roland's gun opened his mouth in a red scream almost all the way down to his Adam's apple.
"This can't be happening," Jonas thought stupidly. "It can't. There are too many of us."
But it was happening. The in-world boys had struck unerringly at the fracture line, were performing what amounted to a textbook example of how gunslingers were supposed to attack when the odds were bad. And Jonas's coalition of ranchers, cowboys, and town tough boys had shattered. Those not dead were fleeing to every point of the compass, spurring their horses as if 100 devils paroled from hell were in pursuit. They were far from 100, but they fought like 100. Bodies were scattered in the dust everywhere, and as Jonas watched, he saw the one serving as their back door, Stockworth, ride down another man, bump him out of his saddle, and put a bullet in his head as he fell.
"Gods of the earth," he thought, "that was Croydon, him that owns a piano ranch."
Except he didn't own it anymore. And now Dearborn was bearing down on Jonas with his gun drawn. Jonas snatched the drawstring looped around the horn of his saddle and unwound it with two fast, hard snaps of the wrist. He held the bag up in the windy air, his teeth bared and his long white hair streaming.
"Come any closer and I'll smash it! I mean it, you damned puppy! Stay where you are!"
Roland never hesitated in his headlong gallop, never paused to think. His hands did his thinking for him now, and when he remembered all this later, it was distant and silent and queerly warped, like something seen in a flawed mirror or a wizard's glass.
Jonas thought, "Gods, it's him! It's Arthur Eld himself come to take me!"
And as the barrel of Roland's gun opened in his eye, like the entrance to a tunnel or a mine shaft, Jonas remembered what the brat had said to him in the dusty dooryard of that burned-out ranch. The soul of a man such as you can never leave the West.
I knew, Jonas thought. Even then I knew my car had pretty well run out. But surely he won't risk the ball. He can't risk the ball. He's the din of this quartet, and he can't risk it.
To me, Jonas screamed. To me, boys. There are only three, for God's sake. To me, you cowards!
But he was alone. Langill killed, with his idiotic machine gun lying by his side, Roy a corpse glaring up at the bitter sky, Quint fled, Hookie dead, the ranchers who had ridden with them gone, only Clay still lived, and he was miles from here.
"I'll smash it!"
he shrieked at the cold-eyed boy, bearing down on him like death's sleekest engine.
"Before all the gods, I'll—"
Roland thumbed back the hammer of his revolver and fired. The bullet struck the center of the tattooed hand holding the drawstring cord and vaporized the palm, leaving only fingers that twitched their random way out of a spongy red mass. For just a moment, Roland saw the blue coffin, and then it was covered by downspilling blood. The bag dropped, and as Rusher collided with Jonas's horse and slewed it to the side, Roland caught the bag deftly in the crook of one arm. Jonas, screaming in dismay as the prize left him, grabbed at Roland, caught his shoulder, and almost succeeded in turning the gunslinger out of his saddle. Jonas's blood rained across Roland's face in hot drops.
"Give it back, you brat!"
Jonas clawed under his serape and brought out another gun.
"Give it back, it's mine!"
"Not anymore," Roland said. And as Rusher danced around, quick and delicate for such a large animal, Roland fired two point-blank rounds into Jonas's face. Jonas's horse bolted out from under him, and the man with the white hair landed spread-eagled on his back with a thump. His arms and legs spasmed, jerked, trembled, then stilled. Roland looped the bag's drawstring over his shoulder and rode back toward Alen and Cuthbert, ready to give aid. But there was no need. They sat their horses side by side in the blowing dust at the end of a scattered road of dead bodies, their eyes wide and dazed, eyes of boys who have passed through fire for the first time and can hardly believe they have not been burned. Only Alen had been wounded. A bullet had opened his left cheek, a wound that healed clean, but left a scar he bore until his dying day. He could not remember who had shot him, he said later on, or at what point of the battle. He had been lost to himself during the shooting, and had only vague memories of what had happened after the charge began. Cuthbert said much the same. "Roland," Cuthbert said now. He passed a shaky hand down his face. "Heil, gunslinger." "Heil." Cuthbert's eyes were red and irritated from the sand, as if he had been crying. He took back the unspent silver slingshot balls when Roland handed them to him without seeming to know what they were. "Roland, we're alive." "Yes." Alen was looking around dazedly. "Where did the others go?" "I'd say at least 25 of them are back there," Roland said, gesturing at the road of dead bodies. "The rest," he waved his hand, still with a revolver in it, in a wide half-circle, "they've gone. Had their fill of mid-world's wars, I wot." Roland slipped the drawstring bag off his shoulder, held it before him on the bridge of his saddle for a moment, and then opened it. For a moment, the bag's mouth was black, and then it filled with the irregular pulse of a lovely pink light. It crept up the gunslinger's smooth cheeks like fingers and swam in his eyes. "Roland," Cuthbert said, suddenly nervous, "I don't think you should play with that, especially not now. They'll have heard the shooting out at Hanging Rock. If we're going to finish what we started, we don't have time for..." Roland ignored him. He slipped both hands into the bag and lifted the wizard's glass out.
He held it up to his eyes, unaware that he had smeared it with droplets of Jonas's blood. The ball did not mind. This was not the first time it had been blood-touched. It flashed and swirled formlessly for a moment, and then its pink vapors opened like curtains. Roland saw what was there and lost himself within it.